I think you all know that Frankenstein is the name of the monster who, when he was given new life with the electrodes protruding out of his brain, he rose up off the table and attacked his own creator. A lot of you saw that horror movie back in the 1930s, and that's why I've entitled a brand new article coming in 21st Century Watch, The Frankenstein Monster We Helped to Build. You can imagine, after looking at all the many headlines in the archival versions of The Plain Truth, The Good News, Tomorrow's World, and 20th Century Watch, some of which read like this, the beast rises up in Europe, a monster stirs, a Frankenstein monster looms in Europe. And over the decades, these have been titles, and many like them, of articles that I have written warning about what was happening in Germany, about eventual German revanchism and resurgence, about the eventual reunification of Germany and the unification of all of Europe, and the fact that Germany would loom large as one of the great superpowers of the world in the future. Now, back in the 1950s, when you talked that way, people would scorn and sneer and say it was impossible, they didn't believe it. It didn't appear that it was going to take place even in the 60s or 70s. But there are some new things happening now, and you can imagine my surprise when someone sent to me this article, which was on the front page of the editorials and opinions section of the Houston Chronicle, one of the great newspapers of the United States. It says, old beast rears its head. And for those of you who cannot see this but will be hearing it on audio, there is a caricature here of a bald-headed skull that has a blindfold in place, and a blindfold has for its eye sockets a pair of swastikas. The mouth is formed out of a brick wall, obviously out of Auschwitz or Buchenwald, and the mouth is open, iron doors revealing a couple of naked feet being shoved into a furnace. And of course, that is what the article is all about. A couple of quick quotations. Martin A. Lee, who also wrote this book that I sent off Amazon.com and got, and it's a very thick, thoroughly documented textbook type of a book with hundreds of sources of news all over the world, especially in Germany itself, The Beast Reawakened, showing a neo-Nazi with a swastika on his t-shirt advocating white power. This is a fairly new book. It came out in 2000. It was written, I think, in the last few months. I think there is a republished version of it now, been updated. But what triggered the article and for me to write and get the book was the recent elections in Austria. He begins the article, Austria's far-right Freedom Party sent shockwaves through Europe when it won 20% of the vote in recent national elections. Georg Haider, the Freedom Party's youthful, charismatic Führer, is now in a strong position to contend for the Austrian chancellorship, despite his penchant for expressing pro-Nazi sympathies. Another quotation, radical right-wing populist movements with openly fascist roots have made significant inroads into mainstream politics in several West German countries, including Belgium, where the neo-fascist Vlaams Bloc outpolls all rivals with 30% of the vote in Antwerp, the second largest city. Far-right parties have also gained at least 15% nationwide in France, Italy, and Norway. While this percentage may seem inconsequential in terms of the United States electoral system, our two-party system, it does carry great weight in a parliamentary system where these people, rather than causing a representative to run in his own local area for the House of Representatives or the Senate, they, as a party, win X number of electoral seats in the parliament. And that is what happened. It can carry great weight in parliamentary balloting and determine the eventual political makeup of a government. Very lengthy article, went on to another page a little later on in the newspaper. That would be archived, and I'm sure you could get it on the web if you want to interrogate the Houston Chronicle. It would be available for you there. This book cost $16.95 when I got it over Amazon.com, and I just got it the other day. I've already marked it rather heavily. I have not had time to read all of it, but I've read about a third or a half of it, and I have a couple of quotations I want to give you from the book. Some U.S. intelligence experts, reading from page 284 under Shadow Over the East chapter, some U.S. intelligence experts felt that Germany was inherently expansionist-minded, that its destiny was rooted in its geography. Reflecting this school of thought, a CIA analyst predicted that by the end of the century, Germany would not be able to resist the temptation to break free of its Western moorings and embark upon another round of Bismarckian adventures. In the past, Germany's Drang nach Osten, or push to the east, entailed armed conquest. And that was, of course, one of the Mackinder and Haushofer slogans, along with Lebensraum, which was their inherent idea that they were the dominant power, the super race. They had to absorb all of these lesser cultures, such as Poland and Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary, and Bulgaria, and that they were destined to lead Europe. Germany's new assertiveness spilled over into the military arena as well. Responding ostensibly to the war in former Yugoslavia, Germany's Constitutional Court ruled in July 1994, that was in the Bosnia-Herzegovina problem, that German forces could take part in military operations beyond NATO jurisdiction. For three decades plus, four decades make it, I was saying that the Germans would either rewrite the Constitution, which was imposed upon them post-World War II, or reinterpret it, and so would the Japanese. And they would allow Japanese and German soldiers then to take part in regional conflicts outside of their own borders, where the post-World War II constitutions of both countries, our vanquished former enemies, had precluded the use of Japanese or German forces outside of their own borders. They were purely for defensive reasons. Now, both countries, which are number two and number three as world powers, by the way, behind the United States number one, in terms of GDP, Japan is number two, and Germany is number three. So our vanquished enemies of World War II are right behind the United States, number two and number three. The Constitutional Court ruled that German forces could take part in military operations beyond NATO's jurisdiction. Quote, this decision gives Germany freedom of action in foreign policy. The break that was holding us back is gone, exalted Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel, who had previously served as head of the West German BND intelligence agency. Although German officials publicly gave assurances they would not pursue an interventionist or militarized foreign policy, Defense Minister Volker Ruhe asserted in 1994 White Paper that the German army would henceforth function as, quote, an instrument of foreign policy, end quote. When I interviewed Franz Josef Strauss, who was head of the CDU-CSU coalition, and we thought that he was going to become the next chancellor of Germany, it didn't prove to be so because he died of a heart attack before that could happen. He was called the Gentleman of Bonn and the Bully of Bavaria. And he was a far-right, ultra-right-wing man who had a lot of contacts into former Nazis. And of course, if you've ever read some of the books by T.H. Tietens, one, well, there's a sensational book called Germany Plots at the Kremlin. The other one was The New Germany and the Old Nazis, a book called Fire in the Ashes. I think the obvious intent of that title is clear, by Theodore White. There was one called Watcher Along the Rhine by Brian Connells, who for 20 years was a Reuters correspondent and who lived over there, and told of a time when he was seated in one of the beautiful restaurants overlooking the Rhine with the cruise boats and the barges going by. And this German family was there with the head of the family, a big portly-looking red-faced German, and the entire family of 14 or 20 were sitting around a table, and he held up his Stein and he said, here is to the Rhine River and good German beer. And they all applauded. And he said, could you imagine an American in Memphis saying, here's to the Mississippi River and good Tennessee wine? He said, you just can't imagine it. And he saw that German nationalism and revanchism was everywhere present many, many years ago. By this time, and I'm quoting again, I don't want to read this whole book to you, just a couple of more paragraphs because it's so lengthy. Germany had emerged as the world's second leading arms exporter. Did everyone know that? Behind only the United States. After it absorbed East Germany militarily, the Federal Republic reduced its overall troop strength to 350,000, the largest standing army in Europe. Germany had regained its status as the continent's premier military power thanks to NATO and U.S. policymakers who sought Bonn's help in defending Western Europe against the USSR during the Cold War. Although NATO was supposed to contain Germany as well as Russia, it proved to be the vehicle through which German military power was restored. Now that the superpower face-off had ended, German leaders indicated they were ready to develop new security structures outside NATO, which is why Margaret Thatcher lashed out against the Western European Union's creation of a new European army outside the confines of NATO when she visited this country only a few weeks ago. including a European military force initially composed of 35,000 French and German soldiers. Such plans disturbed U.S. officials who sought to prevent the renationalization of German defense policy. Another area of concern to Washington was Germany's nuclear weapons research program. Oh, but that is silly. They know, and you should know, that the Germans helped South Africa build and explode a bomb way back in the 1960s. And I reported on it at that time. And also, Franz Josef Strauss made the statement, which I quoted in our publication that I had at that time called 20th Century Watch, that they would be armed, that they would then be swinging their weight around in the world commensurate with their industrial and economic power. He said, we cannot remain very long an industrial giant and a military dwarf. And he talked about nuclear weapons. And of course, they always would pick up on what the likes of Sasser and others would say when they would go to the Middle East or to Japan and say, it isn't fair for Japan and Germany to dwell under the nuclear umbrella of the United States and to have that much of their gross national product going into the rebuilding of their industry and burgeoning up to become the world's great economies while the United States is strapped with this gigantic defense burden. And we have got to have our tens of thousands of ICBMs in MAD. That's mutually assured destruction, standoff on the knife's edge between the war which must not be fought and the peace which cannot be achieved in the Cold War between the United States and Russia. All the while, Japan and Germany are able to just go about the business, almost as if in peacetime, of building up their economies, which they were able to do. And after the so-called Wirtschaftswunder, when they really began in the Volkswagen plant with breaking up their furniture and putting it into the ovens to get them started to export the little Beetles to the United States, they were one of the most diligent, hard-working, marching off to work 5 a.m., working 65 hours a week people on the face of this earth. I talked about it time and time and time again. When I would go to Central and South America, I talked about how they were outstripping Ford and all of the Americans down there, especially in Chile and in Bolivia and other nations like Uruguay, which everyone knows if you read The Boys from Brazil, that that is where some of the leading Nazis had gone. And I think you also know that I reported time and again about the leading Nazis that were down in Argentina. Remember, Eichmann was real, wasn't he? He really was there, wasn't he? And there really is a place like San Carlos de Bariloche, which is almost 100% German. When I saw German newspapers, German bus lines, German books, German magazines, and heard German on the streets in Buenos Aires when I first went there in 1957, I began to realize there are an awful lot of Germans around down here. And when I heard about the estancias that were actually guarded by people with submachine guns in Chubut and Rio Negro and some of the other southern provinces of Argentina, and began to realize how many Nazis found their way to Spain, Switzerland, Portugal, especially to Central and South America following World War II, and to the Middle East, where a lot of them went to work for Nasser, helped him build some of his rockets, I began to realize that, yes, it is true. The Nazis did, in fact, go underground, and they are, in fact, working. General Klaus Naumann, the first military chief of reunified Germany, sought to transform his army into an independent military power imbued with, quote, a victor mentality. All right, enough of that, but let me just ask you this. Imagine, if you can, what life would be like here in the United States, what we would be like as a people, if we had lost World War II, and if we had been occupied by German and Japanese forces for 55 years. And imagine during that entire period of time, with Japanese and German soldiers garrisoned here, a whole new generation, two generations actually, of Americans coming up, learning German and Japanese in our school systems. A tremendous number of young Germans speak English these days. Would you think that with the absolute smearing and destruction of the historical figures such as our founding fathers, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Thomas Adams, all of our great presidents, all the way down to Abraham Lincoln and even Eisenhower, to where they were instead looked upon as war criminals. If you'd have had George Patton instead of dying in a Jeep wreck in Europe following World War II, if you'd had General Eisenhower and Mark Clark and all the rest of them from MacArthur on to Stillwell swinging from the gallows. And they would have been if the Germans could have gotten the hold of us and the Japanese. General Hama would not have swung from the gibbet because of what he did in the death march from Bataan. Instead, he would have probably put MacArthur on the gibbet. So imagine the United States, with all of its leading generals, tried as war criminals. All of its great musicians, historians, all of its teachers and educators and lawyers and everybody and every, all, you know, up and down the entire panorama of government and culture, to where you had been given, infused with a gigantic national guilt complex. You are the dirty, warmongering people who went goose-stepping off to soak Europe and the rest of the world in blood. You caused all of this. You had these concentration camps in the United States. I tell you, I told people in the 60s, there's a whole new generation of young Germans who will look you in the eye and tell you that Hitler never burnt a single Jew. The only people they even put in those camps were the people who call themselves Roma, gypsies, Little Egypt. That's the only people. Those and a few idiots, they had to get rid of them because they were trying to get racial purity. And I've seen the pictures of some of these poor, deformed people being herded into the concentration camps. And along with that, some political enemies and undesirables and criminals who were arrested. And sure, they were dressed in those white, you know, there's going to be a trial. Are you aware of that? You heard right now that there's an American who has written a book, or he's British, isn't he? And he's going to go to the courts again, and they're going to once again try to try in a courtroom whether or not the Holocaust ever occurred and determine whether or not it ever occurred. Well, I've had victims of the Holocaust sitting in the broadcasting booth in Pasadena, and they've shown me the tattoos on the inner part of their arm. And I've seen thousands of feet of film that were taken there with the gigantic bulldozers pushing these huge mounds of bodies out of the way. I saw grown men, generals, weeping when they would see these scenes. I've seen the scenes of young soldiers going in there and seeing these starved Jewish people coming and grabbing them by the muddy boots and crying because they couldn't believe that they had survived it. There are millions of people who remember it. And there were approximately 6 million Jews who were herded in to the so-called showers and fed Zyklon B. And there were the death camps of Majdanek and Treblinka and Auschwitz and Dachau and Buchenwald and dozens more. And when you go to the Yad Vashem in Israel and you see the entire map of Europe laid out in black marble with the little eternal flames, and there are a couple of hundred of them burning in the name right there, Auschwitz or Majdanek or Baden-Belsen or whatever it might be, and it says 600,000, 1,200,000, 500,000, 290,000, the number of people who were murdered there. And then they've got these revisionists and people who want to rewrite history. I've tapped into their website. I've had people send me their books. Paperback, no. Hardback. Slick, beautiful covers. Many of them. You can get a whole plethora of books rewriting history, claiming that the Holocaust is a lie perpetrated by a Jewish conspiracy, and they believe in the conspiracy theory. Rosenfeld was a Jew, right? Don't tell anybody. Mickey Mouse is a Jew. Some of them are so paranoid that you may as well say Mickey Mouse is a Jew. They believe in an international Jewish conspiracy. And what do they say in Germany today? Well, they don't call it Tel-A-Vision. They call it Tel Aviv-A-Vision. That's common in Eastern Germany, Tel Aviv-A-Vision. You know why? Tel Aviv. Because they say the Jews in Germany are running the media, and they're running television, and they're running all of everything else. I mean, they're laying everything to the door of the Jews once again. Well, how would we feel if after 50 years of being told we needed to apologize for George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Dwight Eisenhower? Let me ask you this. Would the older generation around here and there, where they can, in little towns, there are militia, you know, aren't there? And there are terrorists, aren't there? And there are people like the Ku Klux Klan, aren't there? And they have secret meetings, don't they? And we don't know where they are. I don't know where to go find them. I don't know where their meetings are held. Do you suppose that after 50, 55 years of occupation by a foreign power, some of us older types would be holding little secret meetings where every now and then we would be at a gathering and maybe sitting around a dinner table and playing the old songs like God Bless America and the National Anthem? Would we be teaching our children the culture we don't want to let go of? Would we be telling them that, no, they're lying to you, George Washington was really a wonderful man? or would we swallow hook, line, and sinker the Nazi and the Japanese lies? What would we do? Well, in Germany today, as this book so thoroughly documents, and if anybody wants to spend that much money, $16.95, and get a hold of it, I will tell you this, it may turn your hair gray if it's black now, but it will stand your hair on end, no matter what color it is, because it is one incredible report. And it is thoroughly documented from dozens and dozens of sources all around the world. It even talks about the conspiracy theories and some of the ultra-right-wing, far-right movements in the United States. And talks about pre-World War II, when the America First German-American Bund had gained such prominence in this country, and how the very same thing is happening over there now. We believed, after we had subjugated Germany following World War II, that we could turn Germany into a docile ally. And so we began to denazify the Germans. And the army that occupied Germany, the big powers, actually, led by the United States, Britain, and France, published what was called a questionnaire. The German word for that is Fragebogen. Well, Ernst von Salomon, who was a German patriot, wrote a big thick book by that name, Fragebogen. And he took each question on the questionnaire, what is the name of your maternal grandmother, and would have a whole chapter about it, absolutely lampooning it and making fun of it and ridiculing it. Did you know that the American occupying powers turned over the process of denazification of the Germans to the Germans themselves in, not 1957, but 1947. They've been denazifying themselves since 1947. By the way, this book tells you that about 100% of the generals in the German army for the past many years were originally men who won their stars under Adolf Hitler. That the post-World War II, not Wehrmacht, but they call it by a different name now, and don't they take the word war out of it, is actually constructed by the old veterans that served in the SS and the Hitlerjugend and the Waffen-SS and all the rest of them under Adolf Hitler. So it really is a startling book. We thought that Germany could be rearmed to be a bulwark against communism, and that they would march to the whims of the West, and that they would become a part of NATO. We thought that they would be denazified. And so George Marshall came along with a Marshall Plan, and we began exporting hundreds of millions of dollars to rebuild the shattered infrastructure in Germany. It was a glittering success. In the many, many, many times I was over there, we maintained offices in Bonn, and I've been to those offices many times, talked to the older man now that actually took me to some of the old palaces and showed me some of the areas where he'd been with Adolf Hitler. He had pictures on the wall standing right beside Adolf Hitler, and set up an interview with me and Adolf Galland, who shot down more than 102 American fighters, not a single bomber, but fighters, during World War II, and was a general who also marshaled the air defenses when the Nisenau and the Scharnhorst and the Tirpitz snuck up the channel and escaped right under the noses of the British on one occasion. I asked him what it was like to kill other men, and of course he gave me the stock answer that you don't think about the man in there, it's the machine, and he's trying to kill you, so you try to kill him, but it's very impersonal. He, at that time, had just come back from Argentina, where he had gone following World War II to build the Argentine Air Force, General Adolf Galland. So, I know what I'm talking about when I tell you that you could go to West Berlin and look across, even before the wall was ever up, and I've been there before the wall went up, and see in the barbed wire right over there the Russian soldiers and everything, and that city on the eastern half looked exactly like the pictures in 1945. It was still absolutely shattered. And here you're walking along the Kurfürstendamm, which is the main long shopping street in Berlin, under the, or they used to call it Unter den Linden, the linden trees there in the park. And I mean, it was a showcase. Furs and jewelry and cameras and radios and an absolute cornucopia of modern luxury items festooning the store windows in Berlin and all the West German cities, and the people over in East Germany that were under the communist heel were living just like so many poverty-stricken war refugees. And this was still true up until the time of the wall coming down in 1989. You couldn't believe the difference in the look of the buildings and the streets in East Berlin, and I know because I went all the way over there, and I wanted to go to the old Berlin Museum, which I did, so I could see the original sections of the Semiramis Gate of the Wall of Babylon, which had been actually sawn in portions and brought over and put in the Berlin Museum, which escaped major damage during World War II. I think they had some of that stuff deep underground. But anyway, it was still such a tremendous contrast between the destruction. You could still see big pockmarks in buildings in some areas that had never even been rebuilt, and the tremendous beauty of West Germany, and the way all of those cities, such as Kolbenn and especially up in the Ruhr, had been rebuilt. So now Germany had been reunited by 1989. It is now, as I talk to you, the third most powerful nation in Europe. It is the third largest economy in the world behind the United States and Japan. It has the third largest standing army in the world. Now, what about Germany in prophecy? I happen to know and believe that the Germans are the modern-day Assyrians. That is, the modern-day Germans are the ancient Assyrians. And you come face-to-face, if you'll turn to Isaiah 11, with that same eventual question of all questions. Either there is a God or there isn't. Either the Bible is His Word or it isn't. It's a collection of Hebrew fables and Betty Bye tales. And either this prophecy is true or it isn't. And if you think that there are some Kurds up in the area between a black and a Caspian Sea, or if you think that some small segment of Saddam Hussein's population in the northern section of Iraq today, where there are some people who claim to be Assyrians, are the people who are going to fulfill this prophecy, then you will have a hard time believing the Bible is the Word of God at all. But if, in fact, you can trace the roots of these people, just as you can the so-called lost 10 tribes of Israel, and if this prophecy means exactly what it says, then you have a whole different take on Isaiah 11 and many other prophecies like it. Obviously, it's talking about Christ's kingdom, beginning in verse 1. There shall come forth a rod, that's a little shoot, actually, out of the stem of Jesse, talking about his genealogical roots, and a branch, capital letter B. I have a little circled capital letter P in the margin because this Bible always does that. I have a very large King James here that was published by, I think, the International Press. I forget, but anyway, it's out of print now. And they invariably would put a little circle, capital letter P, for prophecy of Christ, wherever that was indicated. Verse 2, the Spirit of the Eternal shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might, the Spirit of knowledge and the fear of the Eternal. And all of these are prophecies about Christ. Verse 4, with righteousness shall he judge the poor and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth and shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. Did he do that when he came the first time? Is that what he did when he raised Lazarus? Is that what he did when he said, stretch forth your hand, and the man's hand absolutely was healed perfectly? Is that what he did when he said, get thee behind me, Satan, to Peter? No, this is talking about both his first coming and his second coming. He shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. That is divine fiat. That is the seven last plagues. That is the trumpet plagues of Revelation, and especially the last half of it, the 19th chapter, that shows his second coming. And with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. Which wicked person did Christ slay when he was here as a humble carpenter from Nazareth? Zero, as they say, zip, zilch, nada, none. Not a one. But the Bible says he is going to do that. Now, all of you people who do not believe in capital punishment, get ready with your rocks and stones and start hurling them at Jesus Christ. But that is exactly what he's going to do, because they so richly deserve it. He shall slay the wicked. By his command, he's going to put them to death. And righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins. So not a single innocent man or woman is going to be slain, will they? Only the ones who richly deserve it. And faithfulness, the girdle of his reins. The wolf shall dwell with the lamb. There are not wolves and lambs up in heaven. The leopard shall lie down with the kid. Same comment. The calf and the young lion and the fatling together and a little child shall lead them. It's talking about the kingdom of God being established. So the time setting of this prophecy is showing you the kingdom of Christ. It says that, the translators added that just before verse 1, Christ's kingdom foretold in the Bible that I have here, to give you a little idea of what's coming in the chapter. Again, it talks about all the conditions to obtain during the kingdom. And reading up to verse 9, they shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the eternal as the waters cover the sea. It's going to be sad indeed for all those people up in heaven. Heaven is now empty, except all those Methodists and Episcopalians are up there apparently. But God is not there anymore, because Revelation 20 and 21 says he's coming down here. It says the throne of God and the Lamb shall eventually be in it. And there aren't any leopards and there aren't any poisonous adders up in heaven. These are conditions to become extant on the earth during the kingdom of God. Now, in that day, verse 10, there shall be a root of Jesse, same one, Christ, which shall stand for an ensign of the people. To it shall the nations, as that should read, Gentile merely means Goyim or any person who is not of the house of Israel or the house of Judah. And his rest, the kingdom, as you read in the fourth and fifth chapters of Hebrews, shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day, at the time of his coming, at the time of the establishment of his kingdom, that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria. What time? In that day. What day? The day when all these conditions become extant, involving animals that normally were predatory, becoming ruminants that eat grass, and lions will eat straw like an ox. What day is it? The day when he will slay the wicked with the breath of his lips. What day? The day that he will smite the earth with the rod of his mouth. The day that he is in complete control. He's on the earth. He begins to rule over the earth and take complete and total charge. And he begins to gather his people from Assyria. Why do you imagine there would be Americans or British or Dutch or Danes or people from Holland? Oh, I said Dutch. People from Finland or people from Canada, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, people from England, that would be in some little enclave in the mountains of Kurdistan. Why would you suppose that? Well, if you would insist that you've got to take an ancient map 700 years before the time of Christ and locate ancient Assyria before it was subjugated by Babylon, and those people began to migrate up between the Black and the Caspian Sea and through what is called the Bosporus and north of the Gimrian, now called the Crimean Peninsula. If you know who Omri was, who was called Bit-Humri by the Assyrians, or the house of Omri, and he was one of the kings of Israel with whom all of these nations had a tremendous amount of trade, and every bit of that is uncovered and every bit of it is unfolded in the book called Europe and America in Prophecy, which I've written and which is available to anybody free of charge, just to call and get it. So he gathers them from Assyria, from Egypt, from Pathros, which is north, upper Egypt, southern Egypt, and from Cush. And remember that in the 11th chapter of Daniel, verses 40 to 45, it says that Put and Cush are at the steps or the frontier of the furthest advance of the beast power that comes in to occupy Palestine. And Elam and Shinar and Hamath, and these are ancient places. Some people don't know where they are today, and that includes me. I can't identify all of them. And the islands are the coastlands, as it should read, of the sea. So it really is all around the world. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah. Oh, well, then they are different peoples, aren't they? Or is God, like an absent-minded professor, repeating himself? Is he saying Israel and Israel? Or is he saying Judah and Judah? Or is he saying the house of Israel, the outcasts of Israel, and the dispersed diaspora, as they call themselves, of Judah, from where? The four corners of the earth, all over the world. Well, I think all of you in this audience know that the first place the word Jew is ever mentioned in the Bible is 2 Kings 16:6. You have it in your memory, probably. And that's where the Jews are at war against Israel. And that just boggles the mind of most people who are utterly ignorant of the Old Testament and of biblical history, They're utterly ignorant of the fact that four whole books of the Bible document the totally separate national dynasties, the separate national entities of the house of Israel to the north with its capital in Samaria and the house of Judah to the south with its capital in Jerusalem, two separate dynasties of kings after the death of Solomon. And they continued right on until the captivity of the northern 10 tribes under the armies of Shalmaneser. And there were three waves of invasion that removed them, and a much earlier one where Sennacherib, another king of Assyria, had come and taken 200,000 Jews away. And they migrated in the first advance wave before the others followed and went to a place that was later identified as the land of the Jutes or the Utes. And to this day, it's still called Jutland or the Jute or Ute Peninsula, which is today Denmark. And interestingly enough, because half of Dan abode in ships, and Dan changed the name wherever he would conquer, his people would conquer a nation like Lachish, a city-state in northern Israel, and from that time to the later on books in the Bible, it always talked about the northern extremity and the southern extremity of Israel, when it was allied, when it was one nation, as Dan to Beersheba, because Lachish became Dan after the Danites conquered it. But it said half of Dan abode in ships. And that's why the Tuatha de Danann, meaning the tribe of Dan, were the first peoples to land in Scotland, Ireland, and Wales, and why the Danites are still called the, we call them Danes, but they don't call themselves that. You know, we anglicize a lot of these names. So anyway, that's for the book Europe and America in Prophecy, but it is certainly easily provable. And up until, by the way, the middle and late 1800s, the majority of the clerics in the Church of England understood and believed and preached out of the pulpit that the British people were a part of the lost 10 tribes of Israel. And in the swearing-in ceremony of Queen Elizabeth, when the Archbishop of Canterbury put his hands on her head and put the crown there, he prayed about thy people Israel. And that rock that is under the coronation chair that I've written about in great detail over the past years in Europe and American Prophecy is, I believe, the very stone upon which Jacob put his skins and blankets and so on and had the dream, and is Jacob's pillar stone. And it said so on the sign when I first saw it in 1954, whenever it was, might have been later than that, when I went to Westminster Abbey for the first time. All right. He will gather the outcasts of Israel, and there are 10 tribes of Israel, and the outcasts or the dispersed of Judah from all over the world. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. If you were to study the entire history of the relationships between Ephraim and the Jews, and if you were to understand that the ruling house, not only of England, but of all of the nations of Europe from time to time, has actually been all related, that many of them are, if not all of them, Jewish. And you can actually go back and see, it said that kings shall arise out of thee, and the scepter shall not depart from Judah. And the British Israel World Federation has a complete big chart that shows Queen Elizabeth, right on back, all the way to Edward I, Edward the Confessor, all the way back to the earliest kings, including Hermon and his marriage to Tehetephi, and right on back from there through the kings of Israel, clear on back to David in the Bible. And you can trace that genealogical record, and I believe that the royal family of Britain knows who they are. It says, and if you understood, too, what happened prior to and during and after World War II, and how England stood by even when they knew what was beginning to happen inside of Germany and Poland as early as, you know, even prior to the bomb beginning to fall on Warsaw. And they used that as a pretext to jump into World War II when they could have actually done it a whole lot earlier. They actually should have done so the instant Hitler started through Belgium and came around to attack France, but they just didn't have the materiel. And it was too late, in a sense, at that time. But that's another story. Verse 14, they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. Who are the Philistines? Well, that name was given to the area called Palestine, Philistine Palestine. And so the Palestinians or the Philistinians are the Arabs that live in the Middle East that today call themselves Palestinians. They shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them in the east together. Isn't it interesting that it says the Philistines would be toward the West. And if you look at a map of the Middle East, that's where they've stayed, right in and around and among Israel and on the seacoast of the Mediterranean Sea. They shall spoil them in the east together. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab. The children of Ammon shall obey them. And the Eternal shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptian sea. Now that is the seven rivers with all of the hundreds of little tributaries of the Nile River and the Nile Delta that flows into the eastern end of the Mediterranean. With his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river and shall smite it in the seven streams and make men go over dry shod. Christ didn't do that in his first coming. This is a prophecy that looks clear beyond our time, past the tribulation, the heavenly signs, and the day of the Lord, to the beginning of the reign of Jesus Christ and what he's going to do as he comes to this earth and fights the powers of the beast and begins to gather his people back and bring them to their old lands. There shall be a highway for the remnant of his people. Now, let's pause there for a minute and see how much you know about orogeny. Maybe you've seen some of the National Geographic maps. You know that they've actually mapped the bottoms of the sea in all of the world pretty well. Not perfectly, but fairly well. They can show you where it's almost like a plain with all the cracks and where all the fault lines are. They can show you the huge mountains. You realize that, of course, Mauna Kea would be the highest mountain on the face of the earth if you could go to its base, because it would be something like, I think, 40 or 50,000 feet. It would be way above Everest if you're looking at the base, because it's so far down in the Pacific Ocean, but yet comes way up above so that it has perpetual snow on the top of it, clear over in Hawaii in an otherwise tropical climate. But the building of mountains, or orogeny, has meant that over a period of thousands and thousands of years, if you study, for example, Indonesia and the area of those islands and see how shallow are those seas, and you understand that all of that was land at one time, and if you understand by the growth of coral atolls, they can actually measure the degree to which the polyps develop, and polyps, I should say, not polyps, but polyps, and the rate at which some of those old sunken cones of exploded volcanoes have then formed an atoll, and that the bodies of the little living creatures have formed this glittering white sand. And there are several methods. They can also see ancient seashores. For example, after the drying up of the waters at a flood, you can see that Lake Salt Lake, as it's called today, was once called Lake Bonneville and was hundreds and hundreds of miles around, and that inward land basins filled with water took an awful long time to gradually absorb the water or to cause it to evaporate or to leach out in the rocks beneath or to flow to the sea. And there is going to be a complete different topography in the beginning of the kingdom of God. Can any of you think of some other great occurrence that's going to completely change the topography of an area? Zechariah 14. It says the Mount of Olives is going to cleave in two, doesn't it? Let me tell you an interesting little story. Many years ago, my father and I decided, wouldn't it be beautiful when we were designing the beautiful stream that went from right outside Mayfair, one of the girls' residences, clear across the campus and down below Ambassador Hall, and then was piped through recirculating pipes with pumps back to the top and gushed out from beneath a rock. And it was so cold, and we at one time had beautiful big rainbow trout, foot and a half long, swimming in that stream, and many thousands of people got to see that and enjoy it. Well, I had told my dad, wouldn't it be beautiful if we could actually have this solarium inside with huge slabs of stone or marble and make it appear that the stream was bubbling out from inside the room and then went right underneath the glass partition and right on down, and we were thinking about doing that. Well, if you read Zechariah 14, it says that huge river of sky blue healing waters that is to issue from beneath the throne is going to come from the tremendous cleavage of the Mount of Olives. It'll be removed toward the east and the west, and right from the heart of the earth is going to come a gigantic artesian well flow toward the Mediterranean, which will have been turned into so much dried pudding-looking blood by that time, according to the prophecies, and toward the biggest, deepest rift valley on earth, the Dead Sea, which is even lower, the lowest place on the face of the earth. And it says, wherever the waters go in the last chapters of Ezekiel, it will heal, all the fish will come to life, all the ruined trees and grasses will now spring forth and be beautiful once again, so that not only will it be symbolic that living waters will go out of Jerusalem, meaning God's Holy Spirit, but it will be literal healing waters, which will also flow east and west from the throne of God. So it says in Zechariah 14. You can either believe it or not believe it. I believe it. I believe that's going to happen. So because the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea is quite shallow anyway, I accept this prophecy on face value. God, with His mighty power, is going to raise some of the tectonic plates and drain them of water, and there is going to be a highway from Assyria to Egypt. But now, where would Assyria be, and why would you need to dry up the entirety of the eastern part of the Mediterranean Sea in order to get some people to come across the eastern end of the Mediterranean? Unless Assyria was to the north of there instead of way to the east of there, clear up in the area of modern-day Kurdistan. Well, that can be demonstrated by archaeology, by ethnology, by history, by etymology, and by name places, and by many other methods, and that is for the book that I wrote, so I'll leave that for that. For those of you that have not yet read it, you need to get it. Let's turn back to the 10th chapter of the book of Isaiah for a moment, Isaiah 10, and beginning in verse 5. Again, let's ask the question, what is the time setting? You have proved to yourself, and you know beyond the shadow of a doubt, as sure as you're sitting in your chair, that prophecy we just read about the regathering of Israel and Judah, two separate entities from all over the world, is not going to take place until right at the time of the second coming of Christ and the intervention of God in human affairs. And He's going to gather them from the four corners of the world, but He emphasizes Assyria. Now in the 10th chapter of the book of Isaiah, verse 5, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger. You see, God uses one nation to punish another nation for its sins and iniquities. He's always done that. Every time a king in Israel or Judah turned to the idols of his paramour, or whatever caused him to do it, every time they went into idolatry and the burning of their children in the fire, and they went to everything from Vishnu to Dagon to Milcom and so on, then what did God do? He caused them to fall before their enemies. He caused them to be invaded by invading armies, and they were taken into captivity, and their cities were besieged, and their crops were ruined, and their sons and daughters were put to the sword. And you can read the history of it. It's some of the bloodiest history in all of the world, of the continual wars that beleaguered Israel until finally they were carried away. And as it says in 2 Kings, not one of them remained in the land to this day. But they did not destroy the cities. They besieged them, and they starved the people out, and finally they came out with their hands up, and they were deported. Now, the ancient Assyrians followed the practice of the deportation of their enemies when they would conquer a nation, because they knew it absolutely demoralized them. That is why, when you read the book of Ezekiel, you see that he was what was called by the river Habor. I think all the world that was a branch of the Euphrates River, which actually meant Heber, or a place where the Heberites or Hebrews were bivouacked. And he was, at this time, when he writes about a future captivity of the house of Israel, he is writing 121 years after Israel had already gone into captivity, from which they never returned. So the book of Ezekiel, if any book in the Old Testament of the Bible is relevant, and all of them really are, if any book is relevant to the time in which we live, the book of Ezekiel certainly is, because he didn't go and travel to Egypt and to Moab and to Ammon and to Assyria and all over the world and say, by the way, guess what the message from God is? He stayed right there in that refugee concentration camp, and he wrote the book of Ezekiel, and it finally was acknowledged as a part of the scripture and accepted as holy writ many, many years later. No doubt by the time of the reestablishment of Judah, when some of those people made their way back to Jerusalem under Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah, and they say that Ezra very likely gathered together the canon of the Old Testament. So he uses one nation to punish another. The rod of mine anger and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against an hypocritical nation. Why hypocritical? Well, because they take the name of God. They say they are of God. They say, in God we trust. They give lip service to God. and a false Jesus, but they will not obey God. And the primary thrust of their religion, which was repeated out of the pulpit by a man who stood in the pulpit of one of those churches of the former parent of the parent, which I've said is no parent of mine. And he said, let's understand right at the very beginning. I was told this at the conference last week from a man who sat there and heard it. At the beginning of the sermon, he said, let us understand, you do not need to keep the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are done away. That was his opening comment. So let's not kid ourselves that any church, aside from God's true church in the United States of America, even makes a pretense of believing, observing, and keeping with the power of God's Spirit, because we can't do it on our own, the Ten Commandments of God, as Christ lifted them to a spiritual plane in the Sermon on the Mount. They are far more applicable today in the spiritual sense than they ever were in the letter. If you're under the death sentence for hating your brother, as opposed to being under the death sentence for actually murdering him, then I would say the one that says you are worthy of death for hating him in your heart is far more powerful and far more binding and reaches far further into your private life, into your thoughts, than the ten written on stone. And that's what Christ did. He made them far more binding, far more powerful, reaching into every little nook and cranny of our day-to-day living, the Ten Commandments. A hypocritical nation? Yes, because we say we're of God and we're not. And against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge, to take the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Notice verse 7. I think it's fascinating. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. I doubt if there is a German today in Mainz, Koblenz, Wuppertal, Berlin, Bonn, Köln, or any place else all the way up the Rostock, who says in his heart, I know that one of these days we're going to conquer the United States of America. I know there are lots of them who would like to do it, but I don't think there are any sitting around saying, we got that in our sights, and that's a part of our program. No, they would like to see a German-dominated Europe, and this book documents, by the way, even maps. There are maps that show pre-World War II, but just after the Sudetenland, after the Rhineland had been reoccupied, the enlarged Germany, including East Prussia, and without the Danzig Corridor that was imposed upon them by the Treaty of Versailles, and showing the whole map of the furthest expansion of Nazi Germany on the wall of current West German politicians and officials. And by the way, there's a lot in here about the German army of today and how the people who are training those young boys are carryovers from World War II, and that they are being infused with the same old song. What I'm talking about, if I say you'd have a little cell somewhere that meets by candlelight and teaches your children to sing God Bless America, they're singing Horst Wessel. They're singing Drang nach Osten. They're singing Wir gehen vor England. They're singing the old songs of the Nazis that were saying we're going over and conquer England. And they're not singing just the old German songs of Wagner that Hitler enjoyed so much. They're singing the Nazi era music, a lot of those young men today. And there's an awful lot in there, by the way, about how they go around shouting Ausländers, raus, foreigners, get out. For example, in the attack on Rostock, that was more than interesting, but they cornered a whole batch of Romanian gypsies in one building and set it afire. And also a West German television crew was inside because of this huge mob that had gathered there, and they'd come all the way from West Germany and Scandinavia, and they'd gotten some of those neo-Nazis together from all over the place, and there are many, many hundreds of them. The police did nothing. The Minister of the Interior said, well, we're short of manpower. And so when these people went from floor after floor and finally got to the top and were able to put some kind of a parapet and jump to the building next door, and there were injuries but no deaths miraculously, then the mob turned on another building and burnt to death a grandmother and two Vietnamese children that were in there. So finally, when the West German government called out some authorities and the police descended on the scene a couple, 3 days later after all the rioting and burning and everything, a group of anti-neo-Nazi demonstrators showed up. Anti-neo-Nazi demonstrators. And the police showed up and arrested them They were carted off in buses. And then, because it was too dangerous for gypsies and, quote, guest workers, end quote, to live anymore in Rostock, which is a city of about 250,000 and is a shipbuilding city and a port, they just put them aboard buses and herded them all out of there and transplanted them someplace else in Germany. And as the buses were leaving, the local citizenry were out there with bricks and bottles and tomatoes showering the buses, saying, good riddance. It tells you what is the sentiment in Germany, doesn't it? You ought to read the book. It'll stand your hair on end, as I said. And you don't need to believe in the location of the ancient Assyrians to believe that the Germans are warlike. You don't need to believe any of that. You don't even need to believe in a god, if you don't want to believe that the Germans are warlike and that they're going to do it again. You don't need to believe any of this. I'm not telling you it's going to happen because it's in a cereal box. It's not in a little glass orb. I didn't find it in a secret ring compartment and something that I got as a gift somewhere. But it is in the Word of God, and I think it is indicated in current history and current events. In verse 15, shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith, or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it, as if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff should lift up itself as if it weren't wood? Therefore, says the Lord of hosts, send among his fat ones leanness, and under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. And the light of Israel shall be for a fire, and his Holy One for a flame, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day, talking about the eventual punishment of Assyria, and shall consume the glory of his forest. And I find that interesting because they are a people that really delight in forest. And reforestation was a practice in Germany decades and decades before slash clear cutting ever took place in the United States and reforestation began. We always practiced selective cutting, I know, because I grew up in Oregon. And it wasn't until clear up into the 1960s that they began slash cutting that they'd done in Germany for centuries. You go by a German forest, and there they are marching just like so many picket fences, huge, big evergreens that you can't reach around. Those trees are 100 and 150 years old. And next to it, a lower group of trees, younger. Next to that, a younger group of trees. Next to that, a bunch of little planters, little trees just now planted. And so they just rotate them. And as the forests get to the point to where they can log them, they log them. Then they plant them again to other trees and replace them. And it's just a renewable resource. Well, they've been doing that in Germany for too many decades to count. We're just barely getting around to doing that in this country. And they've delighted in the forests. A lot of their myths and a lot of their childhood stories are about the forest. And they love the Black Forest and so on. And Schwarzkopf, you know, really means a little hill, I think, or a black hill. And you've heard about the Black Forest and many of the forests of Germany. So it's interesting that even in the biblical prophecy, it talks about consume the glory of his forest, of his fruitful field. And they're a tremendous agricultural country, both soul and body. And there shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth, and the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, that a child may write them. In verse 24, thus says the Eternal of hosts, O my people that dwellest in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian. He shall smite thee with a rod, and shall lift up his staff against thee after the manner of Egypt. For yet a very little while, and the indignation shall cease, and mine anger in their destruction. Now we read the 11th chapter. Let's turn ahead to the 14th chapter of the book of Isaiah. This never occurred. This never occurred in all of history. The Eternal of Hosts, verse 24, hath sworn, saying, surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass, and as I have purposed, so shall it stand, that I will break the Assyrian in my land, and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Never happened. The Assyrians came into Palestine. They besieged and attacked Samaria. They took all those northern tribes into captivity. And they then transplanted a group of people called Samaritans, who were dark and swarthy, from the area of their satrapy or dominance. And they put them in that region, and there they were, clear to the time of Jesus Christ. As I said, they were a nation that delighted in uprooting populations because they know that people left to their own devices inside their own country can stir up mischief and it can have guerrilla warfare. They're completely disoriented when you uproot them, take them to a complete foreign country, and then put other people there in their place, which is a practice of what they did. And they did so in this case. But never was the Assyrian army broken in the land of Palestine. I will break the Assyrian in my land and upon my mountains tread him underfoot. Then shall his yoke depart from off them and his burden depart from off their shoulders. I don't have time to read Isaiah 47 about the great false prophet who lays her yoke, the great false church that lays her yoke upon the people of Israel. And to show you the beast and the false prophet in collusion and ask whose yoke it is, and that there is a great false church who boasts, I shall never know widowhood. There is only one nation you know of in all of recent history that calls itself Der Vaterland. And there's only one great church that calls herself the Mother Church. And there has been a wedding in the past. I've got a book now that if I were to ever really quote from it, I could be thrown off all television, I suppose. There are a couple of books that I have, not only about Pius XII's cooperation with Adolf Hitler, but about the murder of the John Paul, who is the predecessor of this current one, a book about that thick, sold over 5 million copies. You can go buy it. The title is The Murder of John Paul I, I think, or whatever his designation was. But there are books like that that are pretty scary. And by the way, rumors, this is aside the point, but by the way, there are rumors rife now as a result of an archbishop in Germany who made a comment that was really greeted with an awful lot of anger in the Vatican. But there have been rumors that the current pope is claiming that he's going to retire after about 1 year or even shorter than that. He is also scheduled to go to the Holy Land in about March or April. He's supposed to go to Palestine in March or April. He's so feeble now that they've actually had to get an electric cart to take him up a few steps because he cannot make it on his own. And he's been shown to even fall and have people hold him up and prop him. And he walks with great pain and is in very, very poor health. So there is a great deal of infighting going on, a tremendous amount of lobbying. The other day, right next to St. Peter's Square, there was a great big demonstration of all the queers. Pardon me, they don't like to be called that. Well, go ahead, queers in Italy, and they're Catholic queers, queer Catholics, and they were demanding that they want to have a queer pope. They were demanding, demonstrating they want. Now, they call themselves gay. I'm not sure that they're that happy, but they want to have a gay pope. Well, who do you think the black African Catholics want? They want Cardinal Arinze, who is black. Who do you think all the feminists among the Catholics want? They think it's time for a woman pope. So I think the only way to satisfy them all is to have a black lesbian pope. And maybe they will all be satisfied. And don't count that out. Don't count that out. You never know. Just before this pope, who is actually a Polish pope, was elected, they would have said, never will a non-Italian be elected as the pope. But he was, and he is. And so now they want a British pope, they want a German pope, they want an African pope, they want a gay pope, they want a woman pope. So we'll see what happens. All right. Well, I think that is enough of that. I just wanted to refresh our memory about it. And then let's turn in closing to the book of Hosea, chapters 5 through 9 of the book of Hosea have a lot of interesting prophecies in them. I'll just quote you a couple of them right quickly. In verse 8 of chapter 5, blow the trumpet in Gibeah, the cornet or the trumpet in Ramah, cry aloud at Beth Avon. That was the name of Beth El. It was changed house of vanity instead of house of God. That's in God's word, not on the signpost outside the city, but he called it the house of vanity. After thee, O Benjamin, Ephraim, that I believe is Britain, shall be desolate in the day of rebuke. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be. I told you before about that summer in about 1969 or 70 when I was driving down in downtown London, and I was right by Selfridges and coming up on Bond Street, and my windows were down, and it was a very nice summer day, and I heard my voice twice. A car to my left and a car to my right had my program on the air, and they were listening to me as they were driving along the streets of London. I've never forgotten that. But I know that I blanketed that nation with thousands of radio programs along these very lines for a lot of years. And there are going to be literally millions of people who, when some of this begins to happen, they're going to say, I remember that I was told that this kind of thing was going to come to pass. There are going to be an awful lot of people who will remember it. Among the tribes of Israel have I made known that which shall surely be. Verse 13, when Ephraim saw his sickness, and Britain has been called the sick man of Europe, and I still don't think they'll ever be a part of the final 10, and they're going at it right now with Schroeder over taxation and people trying to tax the actual source of British investment in the European stock market. And Judah saw his wound. Now, you know that Daniel 11, 40 to 45, talks about a king of the south who was going to push at the king of the north. You don't always need to think that the occupying power that comes into Palestine comes there as an enemy. They may come there as a benefactor, as a rescuer, to prevent the further loss of Jewish life and occupy the country in order to preserve the remainder of them. So think about it from that standpoint. When Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian. Now, I believe that means Germany, and what have we done? We've asked Germany, can't you pull your fair share? Couldn't you provide some help for us in the Gulf War? So they did. They sent a few helicopters and a few minesweepers patrolling in the eastern Mediterranean, so far away from anything, it didn't matter. Just gave the young guys a nice joyride on a minesweeper. But you also now would have seen, had you been there, the German Iron Cross on the sides of a tornado jet with a laser-indicated target dropping smart bombs on Kosovo, and the guys inside the cockpit were talking German because they were there, just as were the British and Americans, in bombing Yugoslavia back into the 1950s, as my daughter-in-law knows that her mother and sister will tell you. Then went Ephraim to the Assyrian and sent to King Jareb, and he's never been found in the monuments. They cannot discover who in the world was King Jareb, and some of them even say there wasn't any such king. They think he's a prophetic man only. Yet could he not heal you, nor cure your of your wound, and I will be unto Ephraim as a lion, as a young lion to the house of Judah. I will tear and go away. I will take away, and none shall rescue him. I will go and return to my place till they acknowledge their offense and seek my face. In their affliction they will seek me early, seeming to indicate the great tribulation. Now follow on chapter 6. The people say, as if with one voice, come, let us return unto the Eternal, for he hath torn. They'll know now that it was God's punishment, not just an unfortuitous geopolitical event. And he will heal us. He is smitten, and he will bind us up. After 2 days, the day for a year theory, Numbers 14:34, may imply 2 years. Will he revive us? So after 2 years is sometime in the third year. And at the period of the captivity of Israel is 3.5 years, which it is, and the period of the absolute dearth of God's work, 3.5 years, which it is, and the ministry of the two witnesses, 3.5 years, which it is, and Jerusalem trodden down of a foreign power called the nations or the Gentiles, which it is, all the same period, then this may be talking about the heavenly signs, which comes along to halt all human activity and then commences what? The day of the Lord, which I believe is indicated will be 1 year during which the trumpet plagues and then the three woes, the seven last plagues are poured out, and Christ comes at the end of that 3.5 year period. 2.5 years for the captivity, and they are sealed and protected from any further murder, gas chambers, what have you, for the period of the day of the Lord. So the tribulation upon Israel, so far as huge loss of life, may indeed only be 2.5 years, but that's surely a protracted period of time. After 2 days will he revive us. You can't apply this to any other scripture, any other prophecy that I know of in the Bible, and no event in all of history that I know of in the Bible. In the third day he will raise us up, and we shall live in his sight. Then shall we know, if we follow on to know the Eternal, his going forth is prepared as the morning, and he shall come unto us as the rain, and the latter and former rain of the earth. And that's talking about the establishment of the kingdom of God. Verse 11 and 12 of chapter 7. Ephraim is like a silly dove without heart, like a mindless dove. They call to Egypt, they go to Assyria. And that is absolutely true today. When they shall go, I will spread my net upon them. I will bring them down as the fowls of the heaven. I will chastise them as their congregation hath heard. There are many more, but I want to cut it short with a couple of interesting passages that have a great deal of significance to me because of current and recent events. Chapter 9, verse 7 and 8. The days of visitation are come. The days of recompense are come. Israel shall know it. The prophet is a fool. The spiritual man is mad. for the multitude of thine iniquity and great hatred. Religious types are spoken of as fools and idiots. Fools and insane. The watchman of Ephraim was with my God. Sounds like the watchman was paying an awful lot of attention to events and to foreign armies and their advance, and was like a witness and a warning. He wasn't standing around in a priestly robe and making funny signs with his hands. He wasn't among the foolish or the mad. He was guilty of paying attention to the headlines. The watchman of Ephraim was with my God, but the prophet is a snare of a fowler in all his ways and hatred in the house of his God. They're performing the rituals. They're wearing their priestly robes. They're pretending to be men of God, but deep inside they seethe with hatred. Interesting passage. I couldn't help it as I was studying these scriptures again this morning for the umpteenth time to note that that seems to be something that is certainly applicable today. Well, this is a very fascinating book. I'm thankful to the lady who sent me the article. And I want to say to you that if we didn't have our group of faithful watchmen, watchpersons out there all over the world who watch and who will glean from their news sources, this is the only place in the United States I know of where this man, Martin A. Lee, had a full page and a half in a major national newspaper as recently as the 12th of December, 1999. None of the other papers published it. When I tried to get permission to reprint the entire article, I was sent to his publisher and to Marvin Lee. I've been trying to get a hold of him. I sent him an email. I haven't received a message back from him as yet. But I immediately went to Amazon.com, where I knew I could find that title, found it, ordered it, and got the book within 3 days. It is a hair raiser. And as you might well know, it probably is not a bestseller. People don't like to read this kind of thing. It isn't entertaining reading. But the Frankenstein that we have built is rising from the table, and he's heading this way.